Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm your host and narrator, Eric Peabody. And tonight, I have good news for you. Due to the positive response we got a few weeks back, we now have two more stories from Ambrose Ibsen. First, we'll be reading Rotter. In this tale, our narrator, Chris, has invited his friend Jonathan over for a Halloween hangout. Jonathan is a friend that I think many of us have. You know, the one that sends you all of the most fucked up shit they find online. Well, tonight, Jonathan has something new to show Chris, something that will put the roving spooks and spirits in the streets to shame. Then, in A Certain Smile, A Certain Sadness, our narrator tells us of his younger days spent with his grandfather. Though he remembers this time fondly, there was one instance where his grandfather told him a story that stuck with him over the years. It's a tale of loss, a tale of greed, and possibly a tale of revenge. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Ambrose Ibsen, I give you Rotter. Jonathan always found the best stuff. I suppose when you're an insomniac, you've got to find something to fill the wee small hours with. In Jonathan's case, he'd scour the web till dawn, searching for novelty. Sometimes, he'd trawl the digital deeps and wind up with an anemic yield, finding only lame reposts and edgy trash. There were other times, though, when his nightly haunting of certain forums and obscure chat rooms would bring him into contact with truly interesting, and at times, repulsive, content. Spending so much time in such circles, it's a wonder he didn't delve into the dark web sooner. Let me begin by admitting I'm no technophile, and I never have been. I know my way around a word processor and play a mean game of Minesweeper, but at day's end, I just haven't got the patience to sit behind a computer for hours hunting for something to gawk at. Now and then, I can dig up a solid meme or scream or video, but compared to the nuggets Jonathan used to stumble upon, it's all small potatoes. All this to say, the stuff we watched that Halloween night was his idea. I wouldn't have been able to find it on my own had I tried. When you're plugged into social media or using your phone to passively absorb entertainment on popular sites, it's easy to regard the web as harmless. But for those who dare to peer under the surface, there's a lot more to the internet than cat videos and political rage bait. Looking for hard drugs or illegal research chemicals? No problem. Want to have someone draw up phony legal documents or stage surveillance cam footage that no one will question? It's all yours, for a price. Got a jealous lover or annoying coworker in need of killing? If you've got an internet connection and a bit of know-how, you're in luck. There are pockets of the web, inaccessible to the general public, where terrible things happen in real time and utter nightmares are bought, sold, and chronicled. These sites, sometimes termed red rooms, don't show up in search engines, and sometimes you need specialized software just to connect to them. Considered little more than an urban myth by many, like the snuff films of yesteryear, red rooms are said to be live streams depicting depraved and violent acts, up to and including actual murder. I've never visited one of these so-called red rooms and can't say whether or not they really exist. But once, and only once, Jonathan showed me something very much like a red room. And I wish I'd never seen it. Trick-or-treaters aren't as common as they once were. When I was a kid, we'd stay out past 10, 11, long after most of the porch lights had been shut off and our neighborhood had been soaked in shadow. Halloween was the one night of the year you could get away with that. The mischief was built in, expected. Now, I guess, kids prefer to stay inside on Halloween, parked in front of phones and tablets. Well, that's exactly what Jonathan and I were doing on this particular Halloween. I had the night off and invited him over to help me pass out candy, the lion's share of which we wound up wolfing down ourselves. A 24-pack of our favorite brew got things moving nicely, and I threw down for a couple of pizzas as the sun went down. We dished out handfuls of candy to kids dressed as superheroes and princesses, but found the streets empty by 8. I remember Jonathan asked me about work, talked about a recent argument he'd had with his father, who he still lived with and helped care for, and gushed endlessly on about a new online game he'd been playing. I could tell, though, that something else was on his mind. His long hair seemed to me more unkempt than usual that night, and the circles under his eyes were darker. He fidgeted a lot more, and little things like the sounds of dry leaves rustling against the sidewalk or the far-off laughter of neighborhood kids made him stir violently. "Watch any good shows lately?" I asked him. "I took a sick day last week and binge-watched this new anime. The animation these days is such a turn-off, though. I miss when it was all hand-drawn." "Not really," he replied. "My dad's been a real slave driver recently. He spends most of his life in front of that TV, but has the gall to break my nuts for spending all my time online. He never shuts up." "He's still in the wheelchair?" I asked. "Did that wound on his leg close up?" Jonathan shook his head and waited until a few masked kids moseyed on from the porch. "Nah, I had to take him in for another round of antibiotics. He acts like it's my fault, too. I tried to do the dressing changes, but I'm not a nurse, you know. I kept asking my sister to come visit to take care of him for a few days, but she lives out on the coast and has better things to do."
"Doesn't she have kids?"
"Two of them, yeah, and she works a lot, too. I shouldn't complain, but it's all been on my shoulders since Mom passed."
"That sucks, man." He shrugged.
"It is what it is."
We carried on in this way for a while, reminiscing about college, trading bits of gossip, and patching over uncharacteristic silences by playing the Monster Mash on repeat. I could tell that he was holding back, that he was biding his time. He'd accepted my invitation, but when it came to all this festive stuff, he was clearly just going through the motions. I wondered what was eating at him. It wasn't until we went inside, put some work in on the pizzas, and threw back a couple more drinks, that he told me what was really on his mind.
"Chris, there's something I've been dying to show you."
He'd brought a backpack along with him, and I already knew what was inside. Jonathan always carried his laptop around, as much to keep up with his bustling digital life as to show me new and interesting things he'd come across while web surfing. He eased the laptop out and set it on my kitchen table, continuing. "All this dark web stuff I've been looking into recently, the Red Rooms, you remember?" I cracked the tab on a fresh beer and emptied it in a few gulps. "Not really," I hissed through the sting of carbonation. "That's some kind of porn thing?" "No, no," he said. "The Red Rooms." He waggled his brows as if the gesture might jog my memory. "A live stream, right? Anything can happen, even murder, for the right price." "Oh, right," I chuckled. "The sicko stuff. I remember, I remember. What about it? You're not burning your bitcoins to watch e-girls get their throats slashed, are you?" He laughed, easing the laptop open, but keeping the screen pressed to him covetously. "Not exactly." He cleared his throat, glancing around the dining nook as if to make sure the two of us were alone. He was seated by the window, and I remember thinking it odd, funny even, that he stopped mid-sentence to draw the curtains. Jonathan had shown me some pretty twisted stuff before, but he'd never acted like this while doing it. I could tell that he was getting ready to share a real whopper.
A while back," he continued, voice low despite us being alone in the house, "I happened upon this weird site. Someone mentioned it in one of the chat rooms I frequent. It's fairly new."
"Yeah?" I put in. "And it's one of these Red Rooms? They're real?"
"Not exactly," said Jonathan. "But it's kind of like that. Anyway, it's one of the weirdest and creepiest things I've ever seen on the web."
"That's saying something," I replied with a grin, considering the fact that you once showed me that video with the...
"I've shown you some real doozies, no doubt," he interjected. "But this one blew my socks off."
He let his computer power up and then threw a narrow glance over the bezel.
"You want to see it?"
The night was young, and seeing as how it was Halloween, I wasn't about to chicken out. The beers had me feeling good and loose, and I admit that Jonathan's strange behavior had piqued my curiosity.
"Yeah, why not? How bad could it be?"
Jonathan moved over to my side of the table, and when he'd spent a few moments pounding on the keys, he pushed our plates out of the way and situated the computer between us. On screen was what I can only call a simple, no, an outdated, ugly website. The header, written in chaotic, scratchy text that would have looked at home on a death metal album cover, read simply, "Rotter." Jonathan's fingers hovered over the trackpad for a few nervous moments. Then, licking his lips, he began to scroll down the black page, which hosted a number of grainy photos in neat rows. These photos, 8 in total, were framed in the same livid shade of red as the header text, and their pixelated subjects appeared at least somewhat uniform. I still wasn't sure what I was looking at, but understood these red blocks to be links of some kind. The 8th and last of these was quickly clicked, and Jonathan seemed to tense as a new page began to load. The browser was dominated by a large viewing window, similar in shape and function to those on popular video sharing sites. A trio of dots waxed and waned from left to right as the video buffered. What blinked on next was, for an instant or two, rather difficult to make out on account of low lighting and poor contrast. It was only by a long and careful examination of the screen that I dared mutter, Is that a body?" some few moments later. Jonathan nodded solemnly.
"Yeah, it is."
"I don't understand. What's all this now?"
"This whole site, it's a place where you can come to watch live feeds of corpses decomposing within their coffins."
He adjusted the screen by a few degrees, reducing the glare from the kitchen light overhead. His hands shook as he did so. The figure on screen, a man, if I was reading the rigid face correctly, was largely bathed in darkness. From somewhere just out of frame, there came a faint, powdery light, the effect and weakness of which served to exaggerate certain of the subject's features. Only the face and a portion of the shoulders and chest were visible, and the shot had been staged from above, zoomed in on the countenance of the sleeper. There was no movement, no sign really that this was, in fact, a live video feed. None, that is, except for an occasional grainy flickering. I knew that such an effect could be added to any still image to lend it the impression of animation, and immediately laid into Jonathan for having been taken in so easily. "This is the lamest thing you've ever shown me," I told him, flat out. "They snapped a picture of some old guy sleeping and then threw, like, a VHS filter on it. Did you really think this was real?" "Hey, come on, you don't think I'm that stupid, do you?" he challenged. "It's real. I'm telling you for a fact, it's real." "Nah, this is a dumb hoax. I can tell." I stared at the screen intently, looking for patterns in the occasional bursts of visual snow. "First off, how are they powering the camera? Even something with a good battery is going to die after a little while. And the lights. You can't keep a light next to a corpse. The added warmth, it would speed up the decomposition quite a bit. And the whole thing is just so..." I ran a hand through my hair and slumped at the table. "It would be easier to fake it. Actually, pulling it off would be really hard, not to mention pointless." Still, Jonathan wasn't hearing it.
"Listen," he began. "I'm not certain just how they've done it, but..."
He swallowed hard and looked away from the screen.
"I first stumbled upon this site, like, 2 weeks ago. At first, I thought like you did. I thought it was fake. But, you know, out of curiosity, I've checked it a couple times since then. And every time I look at this particular stream again, I notice something's changed. You wouldn't know it just by looking at it this once, but see his eyes? See how sunken they are? The way the flesh around them seems to be retreating. They didn't look like that when I first stumbled upon the site. They looked, well, fresher. And his mouth. See how his jaw's kind of shrinking in? Every time I tune in, I notice that more and more. His mouth was tightly shut the first time, but now it's almost ajar. His nose is even sort of crooked, like it's slumping. And his forehead has a ding in it, like it's gradually deflating."
My laughter echoed through the house. "Bro, you're losing it. Listen to you. Have you really been looking at this trash so closely? No wonder you can't sleep at night."
"No, I mean it," he snapped.
Quickly, he reached over and backed up the browser, bringing us once again to the main page with its numerous listings. He double-clicked on another of the red boxes, and as before, we were faced with a buffering viewer window.
Here's another one. I think this one's been here for longer, and you can see..."
The supposed feed came on with jarring speed, and the screen was filled with what I could only judge to be a youngish woman. It was hard to tell the precise age of the woman in frame due to the serious damages marring her face, but I took her for 30-something. Garbed in black and surrounded by darkness on every side, she too was watched from above, with a light parked somewhere near her feet. This specimen was dark-haired and wore what appeared to be a thin, silvery necklace. What most drew the eye, however, was her crumpled visage. Quite literally, her face seemed on the verge of a total inward collapse, with her small nose burrowing into the recesses of her skull and her lips curled back in an unflattering and permanent wince. The lids hung heavily on her eyes like uniron curtains, and her pale cheeks sagged against her ears. The corner of her mouth most exposed to the light had about it a greenish hue, and the flesh there was raised in a series of black-brown boils. As before, the unmoving image was dressed up with a bit of visual snow and video artifact, lending it the appearance of a live recording. I still did not believe that we were looking at the genuine article, a rotting corpse smiling for the camera. But I was less vocal in my opposition this time around, and more plainly unnerved. "That's a nasty visual," I said, cracking a beer and taking a pensive sip. "Doesn't mean anything, but they did a fine job dolling her up. That bit of rot near her mouth was a nice touch, realistic."
"That rotting flesh wasn't there the first time I tuned in,"
Jonathan was quick to interject.
"I'm telling you, this isn't a hoax. I don't know how they're doing it, who these people are, but..."
He nodded, returning once more to the menu page.
"It's real. I'm certain of it."
"Real, fake,
You know, either way, this is twisted, right? If it's all a hoax, then it's just a time waster for shock value. And if it's real, then it's in extremely bad taste. It would be disrespectful to the dead. Jonathan rolled his eyes. I've watched, like, hundreds of videos with you of factory workers in China getting torn to pieces by industrial equipment. When I showed you those, you didn't have any issue with disrespecting the dead. Say, that site we used to watch those on, is that still live? I bet there's some horrifying new bits on there since we last checked. No, it was taken offline, he replied. Videos of that kind are still circulating out there, but it's getting harder to find them on the surface web. If you want the good stuff, you have to come here, to the deeps. Good stuff like this sham of a website? I scoffed. Irritated, Jonathan scrolled up toward the top of the menu page, clicking the first in the sequence of links. He did so with a knit brow, uncharacteristically refusing my offer of a fresh beer. Yeah, let's see what you think about this one then. What's this now, another supposed stiff? Jonathan ran a palm across his face and sat back in his chair, seeming almost frightened to look at the screen. The ones listed highest on the page have been streaming the longest, he explained. Get a load of this and see if you don't believe it's real. The video window opened. For an instant, the primitive site grappled with my Wi-Fi. Then, with a dull glow, we were connected. From the very onset, I understood this video to be different from the rest. It was somehow brighter than the others. This, I realized, on account of the figure's apparent shrinkage and retreat from frame. Moreover, there was movement.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
We were looking at a twisted human form in what looked to be a dark suit. The settling of the flesh and shedding of fluids had left it blackened and emaciated, so that virtually nothing of the cadaver's original appearance could be accurately gleaned. The corpse itself did not move. At least, its decayed bodily systems were not responsible for urging its gnarled limbs and sunken quarters to stir. Rather, the gradual release of gases, coupled with the progress of pests through the wreckage of flesh and bone, were the culprits. These forces worked in concert to make the whole corpse tremble. Many legged things made their tours across the fellow's rotten exterior, and where foul juices had pooled, rice-like maggots writhed ecstatically. I watched, I admit, in horror. At first, I watched closely in the hopes of discovering some inconsistency, proving it to be a looped video or GIF image. The black beetle stalking about the subject's half-empty eye sockets never repeated its route, however, and it was as I watched it retreat into the hollows of his skull that I realized the corpse was genuine. What in the... Every time I check in on this one, it's worse. I don't know how long this guy's been buried, but... It's been a while. The camera fogs up sometimes because of the gases, and I've seen so many bugs in there. The casket itself must be breaking down at this point. Enough, I said, turning away in disgust. A sip of beer sat on my tongue so long that I considered spitting it back into the can. Turn it off, man. You believe me now? He demanded, kicking us back to the main page. The rotter header burned against the dark background. It wasn't animated, but the thin tangle of lines that made up each of its characters seemed to writhe subtly, just as the maggots in the last stream had done. Suppose it is real, I said. Who made it, and what for? This isn't professional enough or reverent enough to be a scientific study, and I refuse to believe that there are people out there who get their kicks watching these people rot. I don't know, said Jonathan, easing back in his chair. I don't know who's behind it. There isn't exactly an FAQ section on the site. This is almost certainly illegal, so whoever is behind it will want to keep things under wraps. There's nothing? I asked. No clues whatsoever. Your buddies on these chat rooms, the ones who first turned you onto this site, they don't know anything.
Well,
Jonathan scrolled tentatively toward the bottom of the page, past the links to the 8 active live streams.
There's this.
The page's footer contained a block of text, an apparent log of updates and news items. I leaned over and read the latest statement under my breath.
Welcome to Rotter. News. October 28th, join us at midnight EST on Halloween as we kickstart a new live stream.
This brief bit of text was followed by a series of numbers and letters that struck me as little more than gibberish.
What's all this? I asked. Did the guy writing the update have a stroke?
No, explained Jonathan. That's actually the address to a crypto wallet.
A what?
If you use cryptocurrency, you can set up a digital wallet, you know? If someone knows your wallet address, they can send you funds. That long sequence there must be the site owner's personal wallet. I suppose he posts it so that viewers can support the site, or maybe people are paying him in crypto to bury the corpses we see on stream.
Nice. So if you've got a corpse just sitting around in need of burial, he'll take it off your hands for a little donation, eh? Make him a star?
It's possible.
Can you identify someone using the string of characters? I asked.
Honestly?
Jonathan shook his head.
I rather doubt it. The whole point of crypto is to be able to conduct anonymous transactions. It would take a lot of effort, and tools that probably only the NSA has access to, for us to figure out who this belongs to.
Well, what are we going to do about it? I asked, standing up. I paced around the table and parted the curtains, peering out into the dark streets. If there's any chance that this is real, then shouldn't we tell someone?
Jonathan nudged the laptop aside and rested his head upon the table.
Who are we going to tell? The FBI?
Sure, why not? I replied. Isn't it possible to leave anonymous tips through their website?
He fidgeted nervously at the suggestion and tugged at his hair while I stalked about the kitchen.
Look, Chris, this is messed up, but I don't know if I want to get cops or feds involved. That's a pretty big step, no? We don't know where this feed's coming from, and like you said earlier, we can't even be sure it's real. I don't want a bunch of government thugs kicking in someone's door for what turns out to be a sick online prank.
I arched a brow. Oh, now you're singing another tune, huh? Why don't we pull up that last stream again and decide? I challenged.
More and more, I've got a bad feeling about this. Who shared this with you? How does someone stumble upon a site like this one? Your pal in the chat room or whatever didn't find this by accident. I'd bet on it.
He threw up his hands.
I don't know, man. It's Halloween and this site is freaky. I just wanted to show it to you and get your take. It could be a fake, I'll admit it. But if so, it's a convincing one. We don't have to fly off the handle and dial 911. Let's just forget it.
Oh, but I thought this was the real McCoy, I spat. You were over here shaking like a leaf just a minute ago, certain it was real. Now you're just gonna shrug it off? What's with you, man?
He stood up and sighed.
All right, all right. I'm sorry, Chris. I shouldn't have even shown it to you. Let me take a leak and maybe we'll find something else to watch. You want to stream a movie? I'm sure we can find something good.
Jonathan motioned to the computer.
Go on, pick something. I'll be right back.
He left me with an open browser and a handful of titles to plug into Google. After the evening we'd had, I wasn't much in the mood for anything scary. But as the night was young, I went scrolling through a few streaming sites and ultimately settled on an old, gloomy, haunted house flick. I dumped some of the remaining Halloween candy into a large bowl and carried it, along with a laptop, into the living room, where Jonathan joined me some minutes later. For an hour, almost two, I watched Bela Lugosi creep across the screen and nibbled disinterestedly on the same handful of Twizzlers. Although my eyes were on the screen, my mind was wandering darker pastures. Jonathan, having shared his most recent find, seemed in a much better mood now. He'd been privately obsessed with Rotter for some time. By sharing it with someone else, I suppose he felt relieved in a weird way. He finally tucked into the beer and at one point rummaged around in the fridge for some leftover pizza. On any other night, this all would have made for a good time. As the minutes ticked by, however, I couldn't focus on the movie, on the booze, or snacks. Every time I shut my eyes or peered into a dark corner of the living room, the faces of the cadavers would return to me, and I'd be filled with equal parts horror and curiosity. Who could be behind such a dreadful sight? Why create such a thing in the first place? I prided myself on being pretty unflappable, but something about Rotter left me ill at ease. Eventually, Jonathan started nodding off. I poked fun at him. Here, finally, the insomniac felt relaxed enough to get a bit of shut-eye. He chuckled along, but within 10 minutes fell into a deep snooze, head lolling against the cushions and a half-finished beer in hand. The credits started to roll, and I got up to tidy things while Jonathan snored in the veil of blue light. I shuttled empty pizza boxes into the garage and clawed up a mess of candy wrappers and empty cans. After a quick trip to the bathroom and a scan of my phone, I found it was past midnight and returned to the living room. I knew that Jonathan wouldn't stay all night, that he'd have to head home and check up on his father soon enough, but I decided to let him sleep off a few beers and took hold of his laptop. I closed out of the movie and prepared to power it down, and I would have, had I not noticed something odd in the lower right corner of the screen. Earlier, before we'd half-heartedly launched into the night's film, Jonathan had minimized the window we'd been using to view Rotter. To my surprise, he hadn't closed out of it. The specialized browser window remained open. Ostensibly, I could return to the horrible site with just a click. For some reason, let's call it morbid curiosity, that's exactly what I did. While Jonathan slept beside me, I pulled up Rotter and adjusted the screen brightness so as not to wake him. Sure enough, the site's landing page was still there, fully accessible, except that it wasn't the way we'd left it. A new, 9th stream was now available for viewing, the one that had been promised in the site announcement we'd read. I'll admit that I clicked on this new entry, eagerly. I hoped it would lend some insight into the process behind Rotter, that something in this latest stream would solidify it as a clear fraud or a proper horror. Unlike the other streams, this one took quite a while to load. Sickos the world over were excitedly logging on to check out the latest edition, leading to considerable lag. It took 30, maybe 40 seconds before the image finally came through. My initial gut feeling as I took it all in was disappointment. I don't know what I'd been expecting, but the sight that greeted me was in no way different from all the others. It was a dimly lit scene, the inside of a coffin, with the camera fixed on the face of a supposed cadaver. The only thing that had changed was the corpse. In this case, the subject appeared to be an older man, maybe 60 or 70 years old, with stern features and a few sprigs of thin, gray hair on his head. The man looked fresh, so fresh, in fact, that he didn't look like a corpse at all. The spoilage that had disfigured the other subjects was not present here. He looked as though he climbed into the coffin for a nap just moments ago. I felt almost cheated as I watched the flickering footage and prepared to log off. Something stayed my hand, however. There was something about this stream, about the cadaver, that bothered me. I couldn't put my finger on precisely what it was, but as I scrutinized his shadowed face, certain subtle details in the low-lit scene demanded closer inspection. Maybe it was in the cut of his jaw or the loftiness of his brow. Perhaps it was the bushiness of the man's eyebrows or the unique tilt of his nose. I recognized him. Holding the laptop close, so close that I could have tapped the keys with my schnoz, I upped the brightness by a few degrees. Certain aspects of the face entered more sharply into focus, and the feed wobbled convincingly through a fit of artifact. When the visual snow had passed, I became increasingly certain that I knew the face on screen. Unable or unwilling to believe it, I looked at my slumbering friend, my shaky hands locked around his laptop. Jonathan had the same chin as the fellow on stream, and his eyebrows were every bit as bushy as the man's, too. The indisputable link between the two figures, however, was in the singular shape of their noses, large, with a slight and uncommon rightward curve. Adjusted for age, the two might have looked like relatives, brothers, or even father and son. I watched in horror as Jonathan's father lurched suddenly. The corpse took a ragged breath, and one of his large, dark eyes flashed open. A thump, as of limbs striking the inside of a wooden box, echoed from the speakers, and a series of low murmurs welled up in the figure's throat. The murmurs soon graduated into agitated noises, slurred cries. Both eyes were open now, spiraling confusedly in their sockets. There was little room for the head to turn, and the blows that came from his gnarled paws proved too feeble to damage the coffin. He gasped, looking for air, but scarcely finding any. The man was still alive. I don't quite remember what happened next, if it was my cry, the sounds of his father's vain struggles over the speakers, or both, that woke Jonathan. I all but threw the laptop down onto the coffee table, where it fell shut on its old hinges. Jonathan came to with a start, spilling a bit of beer on his pants as he sat up. "Oh, man, did I fall asleep?" he muttered. I said nothing. I was trembling all over, still staring at the laptop with wide eyes, like it had bit me. "I slept through the movie," he continued, easing himself up. "Man, what time is it?" He glanced at his phone and uttered a string of curses. "I gotta be getting home." He picked up his computer and carried it back to his bag in the kitchen. Helping himself to a glass of water, he laughed, made some small talk about how well he'd slept. "Didn't mean to stay so long, man. I'll get out of your hair." I followed him into the kitchen, then over to the door, where he stepped back into his shoes and prepared to leave. "You gotta go check on your dad, huh?" I said. The question was bait, and I studied his reaction to it very carefully. He hesitated a little, double-checking the zipper on his book bag, and nodded. "Yeah, I'm sure I'll get an earful for staying out so late." I wanted to challenge him, to accuse him. But then, as we stood there by the door, the autumn coolness seeping in through the small gaps in the frame, I began to doubt what I'd seen. Had Jonathan's father really been the latest addition to Rotter? "Now, this is serious. I want to talk to you about that website, Jonathan." I gulped, steeling myself. "The things I saw on there..." He interrupted me before I could even find the right words. "I've been thinking about what you said, Chris," he began. He had his back to me, was facing the door, but I could tell he was smiling. "You're right, man. You were totally right. It's a hoax. Rotter is just a scam, no doubt about it. It was stupid of me to get so wrapped up in it." I stared at the bag he clutched in his left hand. The laptop in it subtly shifted, and I couldn't help imagining the thing full of twitching, severed limbs. "Anyway, forget all about it," he continued. "Just forget I ever showed it to you, man." It may have only been my dazed mental state, but those parting words of his struck me as a warning more than anything. It was not friendly advice. I was being subtly instructed to wash my hands of the affair, lest I wind up on a future live stream. He opened the door and stepped out onto the porch. I watched him hop into his car and pull out of the driveway, and within 30 seconds, he was completely out of sight. Jonathan and I don't hang out anymore. I started dodging his calls and texts, and the two of us grew apart after that night. Even if I'd somehow gotten the matter all wrong, even if Jonathan hadn't arranged to have his father buried alive and the murder live-streamed on an obscure dark web platform, the Halloween incident was a wake-up call for me, and I decided to make more normal friends. Sitting up all night watching shocking videos is a great way to rot your brain. I decided to ditch the guy and take up hiking or rock climbing instead. After a lot of mental back and forth, I fired up my own computer the next morning and filed one of those anonymous tips on the FBI website. I don't believe anything's come of it, and I'm not sure that anything ever will. Sites like these are probably a dime a dozen on the dark web, and identifying guilty parties is next to impossible thanks to layers upon layers of encryption and digital redirection. Anyhow, Jonathan hasn't gotten picked up by the feds on account of my little tip, and I've seen nothing in the news about Rotter being investigated either. For weeks and months after, I occasionally did some sleuth work, trying to dig into the history of this terrible site. As can be imagined, I didn't uncover a whole lot. The kinds of people who are close to this sort of thing are precisely the ones who know better than to run their mouths about it. I never worked up the nerve to dive into the deep web myself, to actually dig up the site, but I made burner accounts on a few forums and chat rooms and asked savvier netizens about Rotter. Last month, I got a reply from an anonymous user claiming to be familiar with the site. He said that it was no longer online, that the owner had shut it down and possibly relaunched it under a different name and address. This is a common move for sites hosting illegal content. At the first whiff of trouble, they'll abandon ship and regroup in some other dark corner of the web. If Rotter is still out there, I don't know what name or URL it's hiding under, and I can't even begin to guess at how many live streams are listed there now. The one thing that keeps me from pushing too hard and asking too many questions is the fear that I might one day end up among them.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You've been listening to Rotter by Ambrose Ibsen. Now, here's A Certain Smile, A Certain Sadness, also by Ambrose Ibsen. Some nights, while seated by the bedroom window, my grandfather would smile. I remember that smile well, even after all these years, that particular smile that a stray memory would invite to his lips. Somewhere between fussing with his pipe, feeding scraps into the wood-burning stove, and humming bawdy sea shanties, he'd find himself steeped in the world of decades past, and I'd hear him chuckling from my spot on the rug. That laugh of his meant one thing. He was about to share a good story. There were other times, though, times when, I suppose, the memories stung him in the heart, and his ordinarily stony expression only grew stonier for the remembrance. The sadness that sometimes took up station in his eyes while he ruminated on old miseries never failed to rouse my curiosity, and I would sometimes set aside my crayons, my blocks, to ask him what was wrong. There are a great many things that children do not understand, and my grandfather, who shuffled off his mortal coil at the ripe old age of 92, knew this very well. When pressed, his expression would shed every trace of upset with practiced ease, and he would distract me by motioning out his window at the crooked maple that grew in the front yard, or by noting the phase of the moon. Once, though, he didn't put me off. Once, when that particular sadness gripped him, he didn't wash his hands of it, but instead let it linger there while he bit down on his pipe. I can't say why he decided to speak his mind that night. For that matter, I don't know what exactly dragged so strange and awful a memory as the one he went on to share to the surface. The moon was high and full, an orb of gold that seemed likely to stream down the velvety sky like a teardrop at any moment. A month or so prior, my grandfather's property had echoed with the cries of cicadas. Now, the trees were bald, and the skittering of their fallen leaves filled out the long country silences instead. The crisp fall air sneaking through the open window, and the regular pulsations of wood-scented warmth that poured out of the nearby heater made for a pleasing contrast. I spent many, many days in that house of his during my formative years, but I can't for the life of me remember what that room looked like by day. It's always dim in my reminiscences. The little room was serviced by only a single lamp in the corner with a tired greenish shade. Knocking the ash from his pipe that night, I could tell that my grandfather was troubled. Though he held his tongue for quite some time, the desire to speak gradually won out, and when he cleared his throat and crossed his legs, passing the pipe nervously from one hand to another, I realized he was on the verge of opening up. What follows is the odd story he told me on that autumn night. I listened closely in that cozy hovel, sitting on the rug beside his chair while the fire popped at our backs. If I think hard, paddling through the noise of the intervening years, I can still hear his voice as he fixed his dark gaze outside the window and began through a puff of sweet smoke. "The world I grew up in is gone, Jacob, and should you be blessed with old age, that's something you'll have to come to terms with yourself. You may not believe me, seeing me as I am today, at the end of my tether, but I was like you once. Yes, I have been a boy, a young man, and, as they say, I have lived to tell the tale. I have little to complain about, really. I've been on this earth for 9 decades already. I've seen my children grow and succeed, and I've gotten to know my grandchildren. Why, if I'm still around when your cousin gives birth this December, I'll get to meet one of my great-grandchildren. I am blessed, my boy, truly blessed. And yet, if there is one aspect of growing old that I do take exception to, just one that I have difficulty with, it would be that an accretion of years gives one more time to sit with certain things, more time to remember. The good and the bad together, the good and the bad. Oh, that's that? You thought the worst part of getting old was the aches and pains, and the dicky joints? Those are unpleasant enough, to be sure. But in old age, so long as the mind remains intact, one has opportunities to stew on things. Happy memories are a joy, and for one who has achieved as many years as I have, one hopes that there are no shortage of those to meditate on. But the more unpleasant stuff, the stuff that keeps you up at night, makes your guts tie up in knots, you live with those, too. You carry them. If you're wise, you learn to lug the burden and soldier on, same as with those rickety knees or arthritic fingers. Once, in my younger days, I had a friend named Stephen. No, I was not quite so young as you are now, Jacob. I was perhaps 17 years of age, now that I think about it. And while we're on the topic of age, I forbid you from breathing a word about this conversation to your mother. Am I understood? She would surely disapprove of such talk as this. Now, my friend Stephen and I, we were both born in the old country just before the war. My earliest memories involve air raids, bomb shelters, things that modern children have no acquaintance with. And what a mercy it is to live and die in peacetime, Jacob. On a warm summer evening, I was out with Stephen, doing some fishing along the small stream on the edge of town. The fish were biting, I remember. You could catch all sorts of things in those days with just a pocketful of night crawlers and a makeshift rod. Sometimes we'd strike out with just nets or buckets and come away with enough shad and perch to feed our families for days. The sun was about to set and we'd managed a respectable haul. Days of good eating, I tell you. But no sooner did we prepare to return home did we hear something overhead. A dreadful noise, one we both knew well. Planes. They charged through the sky, making a terrific racket, and left a whistling in their wake that made the hairs on our arms stand at attention. They were bombers, and within seconds, our hometown was chewed up by explosives. I pray you'll never see the likes of it, Jacob. Your friends and neighbors blown to smithereens, your hometown filled with smoldering craters. And the smell. It was a nightmare. I'd never been more scared in my life. you'd better believe we ran for cover. But of course, when fire's raining down from the sky and buildings are being knocked into rubble, there isn't much you can do except hope for the best. We cowered, still knee-deep in the stream, until the planes finished flying past. Oh, they were thorough. They made at least two or three passes that evening, and they left the town brighter than they found it for the fires that now burned all across it. It had all been so unexpected. Our betters had assured us that the war was nearly won and that a bombing of this scale was an impossibility. Because of that, we all got caught unawares. There'd been no time for evacuations, no piling into the shelters. No time to start up the klaxons either. They hit us before we saw it coming, and people, good people, were destroyed within their very homes or while walking down the street. Stephen and I abandoned our things by the stream and rushed home after that, but we had a miserable time of it. Most of the streets, the major ones anyway, were rubble. The smoke was coming in so thick that we could hardly see, and the fires were beginning to spread. We went shambling through town looking for survivors. For a good while, perhaps 30 minutes, we didn't encounter even one. There were bodies, of course. Men, women, children, you name it, all cast about the scene. Collapsed houses were many, and in the distance we could hear the screams of those trapped within them. Most of those died out soon enough, though. Some succumbed to injuries, others to the smoke and flame. It was horrific to behold, worse than anything you see in the movies. Eventually, I can't remember how, we made it back to our neighborhood. Every other house looked to have been flattened, and the ones that still stood were hardly in good repair. Tongues of flame raged from the gaps in the ruins and sent clouds of black, choking smoke into the sky. We shouted at the top of our lungs, looking for our families, our neighbors. One of the most frightening things I remember from that day was the silence in the wake of our cries. We felt like the last two people on Earth. Our families survived the attack. We lost much, of course. Our homes were in ruins and most of our possessions had been destroyed. But our lives, the most important things, had been preserved. Not that we had much time for warm reunions. No, being 17 and able-bodied, we had to join the others in searching for survivors. Later on, in the middle of the night, the town would be filled with soldiers, and they were the ones who did most of the heavy lifting in that regard. We just had to do what we could until they showed up. Stephen and I went poking around, joined up with other neighborhood kids who'd survived. We put out the smaller fires together, tried to round up some of the injured and elderly. It was quite a job, I tell you. In the process, we discovered a few casualties that were hard to swallow. Friends of ours, people we'd known all our lives, friendly neighbors, pets. There was one, too, that I'll never forget. A block or two down from our houses, Stephen and I found a bombed-out shell still standing on a small hillock. It had burned a while, but not as badly as some of the others, so that when we happened upon it, we were able to enter without too much trouble. We found a chaotic scene in there. Bits of the floor were missing, the windows were all broken out, and the roof had partially collapsed. And also, we found the woman who had lived there. She was a young, pretty woman, a school teacher. She'd only just moved in a month or two prior to the attack and couldn't have been more than 5 or 6 years older than Stephen and I. Always well-dressed, with some lovely pieces of jewelry, she turned a lot of heads in town. Her husband, a military officer, was currently serving in a distant theater. He wouldn't find out about her fate till a month or so after the fact. The woman was dead. She was splayed out on the floor, her fine white dress singed, her hair dusty and tangled around the leg of a chair. Her eyes were wide, blank and bulging as ping pong balls, and the string of pearls around her neck looked so strange to me against her cold, bluish skin. She died almost instantly, by the looks of it. A thump on the head, maybe, or too much smoke during the brief fire. I never found out just how she met her end. There wasn't any time to speculate just then. We had a job to do, and simply moved on in search of survivors. Well, the process of rebuilding was slow. Even after the war ended, it took us years to get things back to something like normalcy. Those early days were really hard, though. Barely any food to go around, spotty shelter. We all looked out for one another, of course. Some were evacuated out for medical care. Some of us, like Stephen and I, remained behind with our families, simply making do. I suppose all of us younger ones did a lot of growing up in that period. This kind of tragedy, it leaves its mark, no doubt. Come here, Jacob. Shut the window, won't you? The breeze is getting a little cold for my likes. I'll see about the fire. You just shut that window and draw the curtains for me. Good lad. My eyes aren't what they once were. Out there on the lawn, I almost thought I saw her. Never mind, never mind. Now, let me see about this pipe. There we are. As I said, the days after the bombing were hard for us. Having reached the limits of what we could do, we watched the military men clear the rubble. We were available to help with the heavy lifting, of course. Along with our fathers, we worked long shifts doing menial labor. For food, we had to rely on whatever military rations we could get our hands on. A few fields in town hadn't been decimated, and these provided the odd tomato or cabbage. Then, of course, there was the stream. A while after the bombing, I found myself fishing with Stephen again. Just the two of us were out there, taking a break and trying to catch something decent to eat. I wasn't having any luck. My bait went untouched, and I was almost ready to start eating the worms myself just to feel something in my stomach. Stephen, though, had more success. He hooked a nice-sized shad within 10 minutes, and in the next half hour he scored a whole string of perch. It didn't take me long to mosey on over and try my luck at his spot. But that was when I realized that he wasn't using the same kind of bait I was. No, he'd skipped the usual night crawlers and had opted instead for a very fine little lure, a lure which incorporated what looked to be a few fine pearls. I asked him about the thing. Where'd you get it, and how long have you had that? I remember he shrugged. He got awfully quiet, and to put me off my questioning, he promised to share some of the day's catch with me. It wasn't like him to be so evasive, to have that shameful look in his eye. Stephen was an easygoing fellow, hardly the kind to act all secretive and such. It didn't take me long to realize where those pearls had come from. In all my life, I'd only seen pearls a handful of times. And most recently, I'd seen them in that blown-out house, where the two of us had stumbled upon the young teacher's body. Stephen knew I wasn't stupid, and before we left the stream, he confessed everything to me. He made me promise not to tell anyone. And to my credit, Jacob, I kept that promise. Till tonight, at least. But the older I've gotten, the more I've wanted to break this particular promise. You see, there are some things that shouldn't be covered up. There are things in this life that should be brought to light. After the bombing, while we'd been tasked with looking for survivors, Stephen had gone off on his own. It had been fairly late at night, and things had been so chaotic that no one had batted an eye at young Stephen wandering the ruined streets. He told me that he made his way back to that house on the hill, that when he was sure there was no one nearby, he crept inside. There, with only the firelight pouring out of other buildings to see by, he stole across the rickety floors of the house and approached the dead woman. He helped himself to the string of pearls around her neck. They'd simply been too beautiful, he said. The moment he'd laid eyes on them that first time, he'd felt compelled to go back for them. The woman is dead, he told me. What need does she have of them anymore? Why oughtn't I enjoy them? That was his reasoning, I suppose. When the war was over, he planned to sell them off to make some money a few towns over. I kept my word. I didn't tell anyone. Not that it didn't make me feel awfully uneasy. When we were through with that little chat, I didn't even want to eat the fish he'd caught with the aid of those ill-gotten pearls. But I tried to put it out of my head, Jacob. Stealing from the dead, especially under circumstances like those, it's unspeakable. It's disgusting, is what it is. But all of us, at some point or another, do things we ain't proud of, in retrospect. I figured there wasn't any sense in my losing sleep over it anyhow. If not for what happened next, I might have forgotten all about those pearls. One night, a week, maybe two after the bombing, Stephen showed up at my place looking spooked. He was pouring with sweat, his face whiter than bone china. I thought his eyes were going to pop out of his skull when I answered the door a little gruffly and asked him what the ruckus was about. He pulled me outside, and he didn't say a word until we'd left our neighborhood behind and were walking up by one of the empty fields at the fringe of town. He went fishing through his pocket and pulled out the string of pearls. I remember how they caught the moonlight as he held them, swaying between his trembling fingers. He was frightened, he explained, because he'd seen something while out for a walk just about 30 minutes prior. He'd been down by that ruined house on the hillock, and while strolling by at sunset, had seen the dead woman standing in the doorway, staring at him, grinning. Stephen had gone running at the very sight of her, gunning down the street, told me he'd never been so scared in his life. Of course, I could tell he'd been spooked, but I didn't really believe him. I agreed to follow him out there, and we made the walk. Sure enough, when we arrived, there was no woman standing in the door. I even poked my head in. No one inside the place either. Stephen, though, was convinced. He admitted that the last few days he'd been having weird feelings, especially at night, seeing things in the corner of his eye, hearing things too. He didn't care to hear my opinion that it was just his guilty conscience. No, sir, he believed it was something else, the ghost of the woman he'd stolen the pearls from. We went our separate ways, and I thought we'd be laughing about that little episode before too long. I was wrong, however. The next afternoon, while heading out to the stream for a bit of fishing, I happened to bump into Stephen. He tagged along, still as hunted-looking as ever, and I could hear him fiddling with a string of pearls in his trouser pocket, real nervous-like. I plopped down on the bank and did some proper fishing, while he got to muttering about this whole pearl business. He said to me that, initially, there'd been something like 30, maybe 40 pearls on the string. He hadn't counted them exactly, but knew there'd been a good few of them. He'd removed a few to make some lures, but should still have had a couple dozen on the line, by all accounts. With a quaking hand, he yanked out the string and started counting the things with pursed lips. Then he counted them again, and again. There were fewer pearls than there had been the day before. He was sure of it. By his estimation, he was losing one of them every day. He'd turned his pockets inside out and had looked around his home, but for all his trying, he hadn't been able to find a single one of the missing pearls. If he was losing the ill-gotten treasure, it was just as well. His just deserts, I supposed. But with every passing day, my buddy started looking rougher and rougher. And his stories, well, they grew wilder and wilder. He began to have trouble sleeping, which his folks were happy to chalk up to all the chaos in our region. The war was a convenient boogeyman. You could blame just about any misfortune on it, except for the ones it actually caused. Doing that, you see, was unpatriotic or bad for morale. Stephen was in a bad way, though, and I don't believe it had anything to do with the bombing. In fact, when he turned up some days later, his string of pearls clearly lighter and his features becoming more haggard, I couldn't help but believe him. He confided in me that he could no longer sleep, that he laid awake on the little cot his parents had set up for him to use in their sole remaining room. Very late at night, 3, maybe 4 in the morning, while his parents snoozed away with ease, he'd find himself visited by the shadowed, grinning form of that woman. She would stand at the bedside, her teeth creaking in a vicious smile. She said nothing, made no sound, didn't so much as lay a hand on him. But each of these visitations would come to an end the same way. Something small and solid would strike the wooden floor beneath his bed. Then, the woman would turn and go just as quietly and suddenly as she'd arrived. And in the morning, Stephen would invariably find one less pearl on his string. He was convinced that she was slowly taking them back, that the sound he heard each night was that of a pearl being plucked from the string and dropped down onto the floor. Of course, his searches each morning were fruitless. He took up some of the wobbly floorboards in that old house, but couldn't find so much as one of the missing pearls. Stephen wanted out. See, he was sure that when all the pearls were gone, when the last had fallen from the string, he'd die. It was a feeling he had in his gut, and considering how awful he was looking, I half shared in his belief. So we started to brainstorm ways to get rid of the pearls. We sought ways to appease the ghost, if you will. Together, we ventured back to the little house on the hill by cover of night. Of course, the woman's body had long been buried by that point, and the place had been cordoned off by soldiers for a planned demolition. We snuck past the notices, and Stephen dropped the pearls into a little crevice in the floor, not far from the spot where we'd found her body. I remember him kneeling down and letting the whole string fall from his palm. And I remember, too, when he reared back and started wailing just seconds afterward, hiding behind me as if seeking protection. He claimed to have seen the woman under the floor, looking up at him while he dumped the pearls. No search on my part brought any such thing to light, and I was pretty certain that he'd hallucinated on account of his sleeplessness, or that the moonlight drifting in through the busted roof had played tricks on his heavy eyes. But he swore up and down that he'd seen her, that his fingers had nearly brushed up against her bared, grinning teeth as he'd carefully lowered the pearls down. Regardless, with the matter settled, we ran out of that house in double-quick time and hoped that would be the end of it. It wasn't. Next morning, before sunrise, Stephen was at my door again. He'd managed a few precious hours of shut-eye, he told me, but had been awakened by the sound of a pearl dropping to the floor. Worse still, upon rising, he'd gone rummaging through his pocket for his handkerchief, only to discover the string of pearls there, one pearl lighter than it had been the day previous. I accused him of fraud, of having retrieved the pearls from the house on the hill, but he denied it up and down, denied it with tears in his eyes. What was I to make of that? He'd tried to do the right thing, to return the pearls, but somehow they'd wound up back in his possession. The woman was still after him and his life, he was sure, was still at risk. After all his pleading, I agreed to help him get rid of them some other way. The plan I came up with was a simple one. If the ghost of this woman was intent on bringing the pearls back to him, then we'd have to lose them in a place they could never be recovered. We took our rods and fishing gear with us and followed the stream for a long stretch, a few miles. Finally, on a day with good sun and a strong current, we made our way to the estuary. It's where the stream met other inland waters and connected to the ocean, see? These waters are often brackish, and larger fish, sometimes big ocean-dwelling species, come through there. Well, Stephen and I set about doing some fishing. We each caught a handful of bait fish near town, and into these, we inserted a few of the pearls. Casting out with our bait fish, we stood by the banks and waited for the bigger fish to nudge our lines, which didn't take long. One by one, the baits were consumed, and the second we felt a bite, we cut the lines and let the fish have them. Slowly, we got rid of every single pearl that way. They were swallowed up by the bigger fish, who gobbled their meals greedily and took off swimming for who knows where. With pearls carried off in the bellies of game fish in every direction, we finally felt like we'd come out the other end of the thing. Stephen, I remember, bawled like a baby. He'd been so scared, so out of his mind with terror and exhaustion, that he fell to pieces once we were finished. We walked back to town together, and he strolled about like a man just out of prison, light and carefree. I knew he'd have no trouble sleeping that night, and for the first time since the bombing, he was acting like his old self. We parted ways at the main road, and I went back home to help my father with some work around the property. You want to know if that was the end of it, Jacob? By all accounts, it should have been. It should have been over and done with after that. But it's never that easy when you're dealing with the dead. Don't get mixed up with them. Don't let them get their claws into you, my boy. Once they do, you're going to have a mess of a time getting free. Now, let's see about a little more wood in this stove, huh? There, she's burning good and hot tonight. I can hardly feel the chill anymore. The next morning, we all woke up to a big commotion. Someone, I don't remember who, went down to the stream right around dawn. While he was poking about, maybe fixing to do some fishing, he waded down into the shallows and stepped on something that didn't feel solid enough to be a rock. He started groping around with his hands and realized in short order that he'd stepped upon a body. Yes, a corpse pressed down against the stream bed. I needn't tell you whose it was. That's right, my boy, that's right. It was old Stephen. The whole town was summoned to the stream in a hurry, and the men quickly hauled him out of the drink and onto the bank. There was nothing to be done for him by that point, and all of us knew it. Most of all his parents, who I'm not quite sure ever recovered from the shock they received that morning. It appeared that Stephen had somehow drowned. That is, the military doctor who examined him before the burial couldn't find anything else that might have served as a cause of death. But there were some oddities in the mix. Yes, some strange bits, I say. I suppose, from where these well-meaning people were standing, the details I speak of only serve to support their theories. It was assumed that Stephen had come down to the stream before daybreak, and that he'd gone into the water to hunt after freshwater pearls. Children in the area sometimes did this, though one only ever had much luck in that line by seeking after them in the more brackish and turbulent waters up by the coast. It was assumed that Stephen had been searching for pearls because, upon being hauled out of the water, his trouser pockets were found to be full of them. Must have been 30 or 40 pearls, all told. But oddly, not a single oyster shell as far as the eye could see. It was odd to them, of course, but not to me. I knew where those pearls had really come from, whose they really were. And so, Stephen's death was ultimately ruled an accidental drowning. Somehow, though, I don't think it was accidental. Why, you ask? Well, for one simple reason. You see, there was another strange thing about Stephen's death that stuck with me all these years. People didn't know what to make of it back then. In fact, they did their best not to mention it at all. But old Stephen, my pal, he died with a broad, toothy grin on his face. That's right. He went out smiling like that jack-o'-lantern on the front porch out there, Jacob. If I had to guess, I'd say that he woke up that night to the dead woman at his bedside again. And just as he'd feared, she'd come to claim his life. He'd disposed of all the pearls, had thrown them all away, but that hadn't cured him of this haunting. It had only run down the clock and hastened the inevitable. Hand in hand, that woman must have brought him down to the water's edge. And there, she'd given him all the pearls back, but only after he'd breathed his last and gotten cozy on the stream bed. That was a long time ago, of course. What's that? You've seen it before. Well, certainly. Pearl necklaces have been worn for ages, Jacob. Why, look here. this photo I always keep of your grandmother in my wallet. See? She was younger in those days. We'd only just married. And quite the looker, eh? She had a string of pearls once too, you see. I gave it to her as an engagement gift. They're in the dresser there, tucked away with all of her old jewelry. What's that? Oh, you're being a real corker there, Jacob. Just rotten. You say you've seen this grinning woman before, out on the lawn, standing behind the trees. Don't be silly, lad. You're letting that imagination of yours get the better of you. I tell you, I never saw her myself. Well, at least I don't think I have. My eyes aren't so good as once, but... The pearls, Jacob? Where did I get the pearls your grandmother was wearing in that photo? Well, that's... Jacob, please. That noise was not a pearl thumping to the ground. It was the wood crackling in the stove, or perhaps an acorn dropping onto the roof. Don't be difficult now. And don't you touch those curtains again till the morning, you hear? I won't have them open, not till daylight. Not on a night like this one. As it would turn out, my grandfather did live long enough to see his first great-grandchild born that December. Just what he thought of my cousin's decision to name the little boy Stephen, well, I can't begin to guess. The birth proved a joyous occasion for him, though. Yet another in the long line of happy memories that old age had given him an opportunity to meditate upon. I wonder, even now, what other strange secrets he held onto over the years. What nasty little treasures might have been found in his pockets at the end, had only someone known what to look for. When the man finally passed, surrounded by his loving family in that same little room where I'd been told the foregoing story, only the creased, wallet-sized photo of my late grandmother, wearing her string of pearls, was found in his pocket. I have that picture now, begged it off my father upon rediscovering it a few years back, and have placed it in a small frame. To glance at it is to feel and wonder many things. One can't help wondering if the pearls my grandmother wore are the very same that Stephen pilfered from a young teacher, now long dead. When I look upon it, I feel myself transported to another time and place, to a perpetual autumn that lives and breathes and rustles somewhere just beyond my periphery. The air is always crisp and earthy there, and the wood-burning stove staves off the chill. In that world of falling leaves, my grandfather still lives, his pipe clenched tightly between his teeth, and I am but a boy, peering out the window at the gathering dusk. One of these days, perhaps I'll gather up the courage to ask him outright. That was A Certain Smile, A Certain Sadness by Ambrose Ibsen. Once upon a time, a young Ambrose Ibsen discovered a collection of ghost stories on his father's bookshelf. He was never the same again. Apart from horror fiction, he enjoys good coffee, brewed strong. You can connect with him on his official website, ambroseibsen.com, and find collections of his work at Velux Books. And that, my friends, wraps things up this evening. I'm very happy to get to feature more Ambrose Ibsen stories on the show. So, sir, I tip my hat to you. And my hat remains off for you, dear listeners, as well. Thanks for hanging out tonight while we talk about dead bodies and haunted jewelry. Of course, there's always another episode of Horror Hill creeping across the horizon. So be sure to come back next week for more chilling tales. Until that time, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.